Hey, Pay Pigs and Prayer Warriors, Producer Lane here. The Big Soy Naturals team needs your help. In our description, you will find a GoFundMe for a family that's been displaced by Israel's relentless attacks on Gaza. We're trying to help them afford basic necessities like food, clean water, medicine, diapers, and tents. We know our listeners' data metrics, and it would be possible to meet this fundraising goal before our next release if each of you could just spare $3. If you can't support financially, please copy the link and share it directly with your friends and on social media. That's all from me. Thank you, and please enjoy the episode.
I don't want smoke, I just want smoke. 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 When I'm smoking green, it's because I'm on your team. When I smoke the sea, because I'm such a fiend. High as a kite, smoking Walter White. When I smoke the blue and I smoke the purple. Smoking on the blunt cause I wanna run. Smoking on the green cause it makes me lean. Smoking on the ground and I smoke and scream. When I hit the blunt, it's a paper cut. When I hit the blunt, I give a fuck. When I hit the blunt, I don't give a fuck. I don't wanna smoke, I just wanna smoke.
Hello, Pay Pigs and Prayer Warriors. Welcome.
Hi.
Welcome. Hi. Hi, Virgil.
Hey.
Hey, that is our special guest for today. Laura, aka Cyber Ex-Boyfriend. You might know him from TikTok. I know Virgil is always telling you to get off that app, but you're on there, and I know you are because you're on my page too, and you're asking me when the next episode is coming out. It's here. Hello. Virgil, the mood...
Hello.
I hate to say it because I know yesterday was Juneteenth, but the mood yesterday really was everything happens to me.
I didn't get to start celebrating Juneteenth as per... the biracial laws until 5 p.m. anyway. So it's okay. As long as those things happen to you before 5 p.m., it actually has nothing to do with me.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they happened around like 4:30 p.m. So funny. Like, I'd gotten off a sound check with our lovely esteemed guest today. And I went to the store to get a cup of noodle. And on my way, I passed the church next to me who was having the gay men's chorus was practicing for Pride. And all the windows were open and they were singing a lovely song. I posted it on my Twitter. It was very, very lovely. It was I Am What I Am from the La Cage aux Folles, like the Birdcage musical. For a lot of these like older gay men, it's like a very like big anthem or whatever. So they were having they were having a great time, and they were doing some lovely, lovely vocals. And like, I could see just through like the window that they were like shimmying kind of a little bit in their little choral line. it was very cute, and very pretty. And I was like, you know, just kind of, I felt very one with the world at that moment. And then after the song was over, cause I sat there for a while just listening to it. I immediately turn on the block, I step on a rock, roll my ankle, eat shit, fall to the ground, skin my knee so fucking bad. Like today it's still like covered in gauze. Like I was worried I might have to go get stitches. I didn't. I cracked my phone but I was literal feet away from the parking lot of the, I guess you could call it a bodega, but it's not really.
I don't think they have those.
Exactly. They don't have those, but it's like the Oregon white people equivalent. And I go there and I still get my cup of noodle while my leg is bleeding. Cause I'm like, well, I'm closer to here than I am to home. And I get to the front and I'm dripping blood everywhere. And I'm like, hey man, do you have like a first aid kit? And he's like, well, I don't know if I can give it to you. And then he leans over to look at my leg. He's like, oh fuck. And then he's like, yeah, sure. And he runs to the back, even though there's like a line forming behind me, and like grabs me the first aid kit. And then I limp my way home covered in very shitty band-aids until I can get like my gauze. So again, it was very everything happens to me kind of moment. And I know I'm making yesterday about me, but
well, do you think that was perhaps like karmic retribution?
I think maybe.
The way that you do and having the eye color that you have, and refusing to get brown contacts.
I know.
Despite how many times I've told you that you need to.
The issue right now is that I am unemployed, right? And prescription color contacts are very expensive. I don't know if you know this. So I'm working my way up to it. I don't think you would. Unless you were cosplaying, I don't think you would need to know. But they are.
My eyes are the perfect color.
You don't have anything to change. But if you do have something to change like me, you probably know that out there that prescription color contacts are very expensive. And I'm very, very blind. That's another piece of lore out there for everybody to know. I don't have good eyesight at all.
Yeah, because they're the wrong color. They're letting in too much
light. It is God's punishment for me to have like a -5 prescription.
On Juneteenth.
Yeah.
They really got you.
They really got me. They got me. So, yeah, I think your ancestors were laughing at me, as is their right. And that was my day yesterday. It was very, again, everything happens to me. It was everything all at once. It was, you know, beauty and failure.
Did half of your day go well, Virgil?
Yeah, you know, I spent it at probably the whitest bar in Baltimore with my friend. They were having a indie sleaze themed night. We didn't know that when we walked in. And they were also doing karaoke. And I think that I'm not the first to make this observation, but it's so true every time I see it that like Mr. Brightside is Sweet Caroline for white people 35 and under.
It's true.
It really like it activates something primal in them. And you know what? I'm half white. I was there with them. Mm-hmm. I get it.
Mm-hmm. I can confirm. I do go a little buck wild the second Mr. Brightside comes on.
I bet you do.
I've never like been a Mr. Brightside person. I can't think of it. Just never like clicked. I don't know. It's weird.
Well, how many black grandparents do you have?
I would 4.
Yeah.
Yeah, 4. Definitely.
You didn't, get think the about Mr. Brightside gene.
No, I didn't.
I can feel like
you had the what's going on gene.
Yeah.
I can feel the capuchin monkey in me just start going like the second the guitar riff comes out. Those first 3 notes, I'm just like, here I go.
Kubian ape instinct activated. How did you spend your Juneteenth? And then I guess we start the episode.
I spent it sleeping, as my ancestors would want. Rest. It was a bank holiday.
Rest.
That's great. Yeah, I like that, like, if you have an email job, you get it off for work now, which is cool.
Yeah.
I have no job, so I also got it off, so that was fine. Kenny, can you introduce our guest with all of the, like, attributes? Because you're better at this than I am.
Yeah, romantic aesthete, I guess. Aesthete, like, you know,
is that how that word is pronounced?
I think so. We have this conversation a lot where I pronounce a word and then you ask if it's pronounced a different way and I can't.
Aesthete?
Not aesthete, aesthete. Oh my god. Okay. You know, aesthetic extraordinaire, king of design, truly the design scholar of TikTok, CyberX boyfriend, Laura Lisbon. How are you today?
Wait, did you feel like that description was correct? Or do you want
I would
more?
Hope so. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was suffice. I don't know. I mean,
if you have other descriptors, be feel free to use them. don't be humble either. Like, this is not a podcast for the humble people.
True. My ancestors will come and get me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have like knowledge and stuff that I like grew up in. So I think this is going to be like really fun because like looking at the notes, I came prepared.
Okay. Well, speaking of the notes, today's episode is a bit of a call out for all of our listeners, maybe like 26 and up. I don't know what is going on with people.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's getting younger and younger with you guys.
But it's time for you to stop calling yourself old, or for you to say that you're too old to know about things or to understand stuff. And I think that like my ire at seeing it, and at seeing it from people who should be like making plans to go to the club with me and are instead acting confused at like Ice Spice. It inspired me to do some research, and something that we've touched on in the past is that like fashion trends, design trends, like trends in culture work generally are like related to and dependent on the speed of production, or like the means of production, as some people might call it. And those production cycles have become so much faster in recent years, and like exponentially faster in the last 5 years than even the last 10. And I think that those things are related to maybe why some of you feel so old. So I want to first get into the idea of like what is a nostalgia cycle? Because nostalgia is like a really powerful tool to influence consumer habits. Like two completely identical products can have really vastly different outcomes on the market just based on whether or not one is marketed as retro and the other one is normal, or is like filling a different marketing purpose. And it doesn't require like any advanced marketing knowledge to know that people are going to gravitate towards consumer products that spark really powerful emotions like happiness. And a very easy one, or an easy way to elicit that emotion is by appealing to people's memories of childhood, because it's a time period for most people where they feel like things were simpler. Do you guys have any thoughts on that? Otherwise, I have a really fun poll that I found.
It's interesting the way it's always conveniently the time that they were a child that they feel it is simpler, because if you just go back in the history timeline of like when they're talking about, even like older people, like in like Gen X will constantly talk about drinking water from a hose, like the second you bring up any kind of generational divide. And like it's like, baby, the gas crisis, like you were dealing with so much, but you don't even remember that. All you remember is drinking water out of a hose and being like a latchkey kid.
That was their water
day. Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up, because I think what really sparked this for me was that I found the results of this survey from YouGov, where they polled 2,000 Americans this past May 24, asking them what the best metric was for the best decade was for various metrics, and then the worst decade also. And so some of those things were like, what was the best decade for music, the best decade for cuisine, movies, when was there the least political division, the best fashion, etc. And across all demographics, like race, gender, income, political affiliation, everyone was in agreement that the worst time is right now. So
it just started.
They said that, you know, the 2020s, worst decade for movies, worst decade for fashion. Families are unhappier than ever in the 2020s. Societies are least moral in the 2020s. Communities are not close knit anymore. And
and everybody sucks.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because I think that there are so few questions that you could ask across all of those different demographics where you would get that kind of consensus of like, what do you all agree on? And everyone is in agreement that right now is the worst time to be alive and have any experiences. And we're only 4 years in.
Yeah.
And then what is also interesting is that a trend does start to emerge when you control for the age of respondents for what was the best decade for music, television, fashion, movies. And regardless of like income, gender, race, et cetera, like respondents will agree that the best decade for anything was when they were 10. Like roughly around the time that they were 10 years old, that was the best decade for happiest families. That was when reporting was at its best. It's when the best music was coming out. I think it's hard for me to understand how people around my age or a little bit older would feel any confidence in answering questions that way. Like the best decade for, or the best time for reporting was like immediately post 9/11. Like, It was good.
That's when you were doing.
I wasn't reading the papers at that age.
Good job on the reporting there. Like everyone was happy. There was the least amount of political division, but it is just, you know, like when you're 10 years old, you are not experiencing very complicated emotions. Everything is getting filtered through the lens of your childhood. So it's normal for people to feel fondness from that time, regardless of what else was going on in the world, because that's also when you're having new experiences constantly. There are less complex trials that you're going through. And the difficult emotions that you experienced at age 10, you probably don't remember them very well. Like whatever those things were, those past with age, and what you remember is how good it felt to hear the song, what was coming out when I was 10? From Madagascar.
The Madagascar soundtrack.
Madagascar 2.
The I like to move it song.
Yeah. Best time for movies was when Avatar was good. Was coming out. Like that's what you love.
For me, it was probably the Berries and Cream commercial was really big. I thought it was really weird when the Berries and Cream commercial had a recycling in the last like last year. Like all of a sudden people were like, oh yeah, Berries and Cream. I'm like, that was in sixth grade. People were like, haha, Berries and Cream. Like that's the most hilarious commercial I've ever seen in my life.
It's crazy because it's like for the first time I'm watching vintage memes. Mm-hmm. Like that's like an archaic meme.
Yeah.
Like, are we going to bring back like the Star Wars kid
mm-hmm,
next?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. You know who we should bring back is Insanity Wolf.
Ooh, yeah.
A little bit familiar. Too problematic for today's yeah. time, but I think that we could find a way
rebrand.
To... Yeah, or like Business Cat.
Ooh, Business Cat. Yeah, Insanity Wolf is like a really old image macro meme where it's like a really crazy looking wolf. Yeah. And then it's just like
so you put... a scary wolf. Top text is like kidnapping? ? And then bottom text... reverse adoption.
Yeah.
And it's just
it's like you tell edgy jokes. Edgy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it like, is that similar to like the pack? Cause like I know the pack memes where it's like something, something cranking my arm yep. to Marshall.
It's very similar. It's very similar. Business Cat. I feel like Cat Icon Has Cheeseburger memes could come back in style. I feel like people
are
yearning.
Our parents' memes.
Yeah. I feel like people are yearning.
We're gonna bring back Nyan Cat.
I feel like people are yearning for that feeling though that old people get when they share like a little Minions meme of like, oh my god, so true.
So true. The Nyan Cat
where the Minion is wearing false lashes and they're like, oh my god, she's in touch with her femininity.
Yeah, and I do feel like you can like see some really simple examples of this like nostalgia cycle production in action with a lot of like digital trends where like it'll just be a photo of like the Windows screensaver from 2002 and they're like, remember this? And then everyone's like, simpler times. I miss when things were like this.
people love Frutiger era, which is really funny because like I distinctly remember at the time I was like probably 10. Like, I loved Windows Vista, but, like, everybody and their mom hated it. And it's, like, weird to watch that cultural shift in real time.
Because, like, infrastructurally, like structurally, Windows Vista didn't work very well.
I didn't know.
System.
I was just booting up The Sims.
It took, like, half an hour for my computer to start. I'm like, I just want to play The Sims. Like, I just want to put in that Rosebud cheat code. And it's taking forever. And then it's crashing every 5 seconds. Like, I can't
that
get
part.
It. Like...
Yeah, because I think over time, like, you then start associating those aesthetics with, like, whatever positive things you enjoyed from that time period. And then those two things become linked. And that is something that, like, corporations have known for a very long time and deploy usually to great effect. Like, even in the earliest days of print media, you'll see products that are marketed with the hook that it's going to help you revive the glory days or take you back to the good old years. And it's not new that this is happening, but I think what is happening is the speed at which like the very, very recent past is becoming the good old years and how that increased speed is tricking maybe many of you into feeling like you're very old, even though you are 29.
Just do some stretches and then go to the club. You'll be fine. Drink some water after your hangover is getting a little like worse, but maybe just, I don't know, drink more water.
Like, Brat just came out, so I mean, listen, yeah. Charlie dropped club music, yeah. So we can't say there's no club music.
She's anymore. 31. Isn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that there is also, like, because the speed of production is happening so fast that the trend cycles happen, like, within a blink of an eye, that perhaps someone who is 31 years old, like, feels alienated from it because they happen and then they go away without enough time for a person to, like, really get in touch with what it's like to experience them.
Yeah, I feel like it's, you know, it's getting a lot harder for people, especially, like, I think a lot of younger people are getting into, like, they unfortunately get tricked into this mindset of, like, buying and consuming so much all the time that mm-hmm. then they, like, they don't really know what to yearn for anymore because it's all just available immediately all the time. And then the second yeah. it's, like, the second that availability is, like, too available almost, then it's just, like, okay, throw it in the trash. Like, okay, that cider mm-hmm. dress you got yesterday because everyone wanted it, like, throw it in the trash. Buy another one.
And I think with the trends too, it's also that like people want to differentiate themselves. So like if I think the strawberry dress is like a perfect example where it's like, I remember like when Lyrica like actually made like the shirt version, I was like, oh, I need that immediately. But it's weird because like by the time like I had already gotten it because it was like a little bit bespoke. So it took like 2 months to come. Like it was already a dead trend because everybody and their mom had gotten like the Amazon versions. Mm-hmm. And like, I almost didn't want to wear it at that point. Cause I was like, everybody has this.
Yeah. And they have really, really terrible versions of it too, where it's like yeah. the sequins are all falling off. Like it's not even like, oh, I want to throw this out just because it's trending. I need to throw it out because it's falling the fuck apart. Like I can't even wear it anymore. I get like two uses out of the knockoff Lyrica Mitoshi and then it's over.
It's
like
a safety hazard.
Yeah, then it's like, it's flammable. Like, I gotta get rid of this thing. It's burning up. Like, it's giving me a rash. I gotta go.
Yeah, well, and, like, technological advances and, I guess, like, the capitalist revolution that happened, I don't know, like, late 1800s has really accelerated the speed at which, like, fashion is accessible to us in a way that would be unfathomable, like, 200 years ago, like I think 300 years ago, which is not that long ago, if you wanted a garment to be produced to you, you had to have woven fabrics, like purchase wholesale, and then you would have to take that to a tailor or a seamstress, and then they would construct a garment. And so the like class disparity thing is interacting with that production cycle too, where their equivalent of the strawberry dress, like I guess that's all that there was. And then if you wanted to have something like that and you don't exist in that class sphere, you just don't get one.
Right.
And so instead, like what you get is maybe something that is passed on to you from years and years ago. You're like reworking clothes that you already have. And so the like production cycle being slow, even for people with wealth, means that the way to display that wealth would be instead maybe showing off like how complex of a garment that you could afford or the amount of labor that you could afford to go into something like that rather than taking someone else's discards or having to repair something over and over before retiring it completely. But even very, very wealthy people would have to make frequent repairs to their clothes. The idea of discarding something after there is a hole in it or something would have been like unthinkable. And there is right. Something that I learned not too long ago about why all of the corsets that we see in museums as examples of what people used to wear in the 1800s, why they're so small, is not because that is the size that people wear, but because people wore their corsets to the point of like disintegration. So the ones that have managed to withstand the like years and years of time are ones that didn't get a lot of wear.
It's similar with when I was working at like the vintage store, gunny sack dresses were really big, right? Like people really, really wanted gunny sack dresses, but so many of them came in an extra, extra small. And that's because they weren't actually like an extra, extra small for adult women. They were children's sizes because those were just not being like in the 70s, those weren't like bought and worn to death.
Were gunny sacks like mostly a children's brand?
They did like a lot of children's brand and then they did some adult like size dresses, but a lot of the medium and large sizes like don't really like exist anymore because a lot of people just wore the shit out of those. And then the kids' dresses, like some people like got a couple wears out of them and then like their kid didn't want it anymore, or like half of them like came like new in the box because like just people didn't buy them. They came from like a store years and years ago and then just got sold at estate sale after estate sale until they ended up like in our place. I would argue that though, like the sort of speeding up of production with a lot of clothes kind of started in the US like around late 60s, early 70s, just based on materials alone, like lots of polyester, lots of plastic. There was a trend for a while in like the late 60s of paper dresses, where these like sort of bigger mod companies would make paper dresses that you were meant to wear like once or twice and then throw out, like that it was literally made of like paper towels.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I know that in like the 60s and 70s, like there was like increased like production and all of that because like mall culture was starting to take off. So the like trend cycle started to speed up over time. But I think what's really interesting is not so much like it's people being sold stuff, but now it almost feels like people don't want to like earn their racing stripes, for lack of a better like term, where it's like back in the day, like ripped jeans, like were ripped because they were worn and like actually like loved and all of that. But now people are just like buying like the ripped jeans, or like they buy a look off the shelf or like patches.
When you say back in the day, when do you mean for that? Because I feel like I was buying ripped jeans when I was like 10. So I think that, I don't know, by that point, which
I think it's like the
early 2000s.
The idea that like,
I think it was like the 90s. It became a thing in the 90s to sell like pre-distressed like denim. I think I want to say Abercrombie like helped pioneer that. But like, I know for a fact that like Levi's, I want to say Silver Tab took off, which has like more like aggressive like washes like to that countercultural and like grunge movement. And I think that because like the grunge look was one that was made because like they needed it, like they weren't like doing it like to look cool, where it's like now that aesthetic is sold to you to look cool.
For sure. And I mean, like, you know, you think about like Vivienne Westwood and like the punk kind of movement and how it kind of got saturated. Like, I wouldn't say it's Vivienne Westwood's fault, right, at all, but it's more just sort of like how that kind of movement became so saturated as like something to be sold and something to be bought, like countercultural.
It was always kind of like that, because I want to say like Vivienne and Malcolm, like I can't remember what it was originally. I want to say it was called Land's End, and then I think it turned into like Sex. Like that's when it really took off. And then they like put like the Sex Pistols in their like aesthetic and clothes. And it was there to like sell clothes, more or less. Like they essentially almost grassrooted an entire like aesthetic movement.
Yeah. And I think that the other way that this in like plays with counterculture aesthetic movements is that if there is necessarily time involved in, you know, having an idea that you want to execute for a sense of style that you have and then acquiring the pieces for it, it like acts as a different kind of gatekeeping to people outside of that culture, in the same way that people from like a higher class background would want something that is more ornate to gatekeep like the kinds of clothes that they have from people that are working class.
This is a huge thing in like the fiber arts community, from like what I hear. Like, I don't know if you're mutuals with Alexandria Maas, but she's like an incredible crochet artist. And she makes a lot of things that are like she's hand dyeing her own wool. She's doing all of this stuff. And she's getting, and now she's getting like people on Shein trying to copy her crochet dragon hats. And what she says is that she buys these and she's like, here's the thing about crocheting. You can't have a machine do this. You can have a machine hand knit, but you can't have a machine do crochet. So somebody had to crochet this hat. Somebody had to crochet all these hats that are mimicking my hat, one by one by one. So they're co-opting my stuff because people feel like they are owed my labor and they are owed like my artistry. But I set it at that price point because of the stuff that I do. And I don't really owe anybody affordability, just based on like the stuff that I make, because they want it, right?
And I think I think it's really interesting how like the value of labor as well as like production and like actually like what it takes to make a product has like changed in the mind of the consumer in like I'd say the past 20 years, where like even more ornate fabrics like silk, satin, and like silk like aren't sold in stores as much. And like now people just like get stuff off like Shein or Boohoo and they're like shocked that it's not exactly what they wanted.
Yeah. And I think like the other thing that or the other thing that you can see in the change with like fashion production and is that if you you know if you were to thrift clothes that are from like the 90s and even the early 2000s, a lot of the time there's like a seam that you can let out with the understanding that at some point maybe you're going to outgrow this and you're going to take it to a tailor to make it fit you. And that was, you know, just part of what the consumer would have expected with buying clothes because they were not buying clothes as frequently. But now if you were to buy a pair of pants, like the seam outlet that is afforded to you is very small, if there is one at all, because the expectation is that you are going to replace it as soon as it doesn't fit you anymore, rather than try to find a way to make this wearable. And that like speed of production is something that even with the Industrial Revolution, I think you can see through looking at fashion history, really did happen in the space of like decades, where something would come down a runway and then maybe the stores that, or like the brands that stock things at the mall would make their own version of that, but that would take another season or two, and then people would be buying that for like a year or 2 years before the next thing comes through. And what is interesting to me to notice is that because the like production cycle has happened so fast, where something can come down the runway meant for you know, like fashion buyers to project what they're going to keep in stock for like the season ahead, but then all of those things can get knocked off by a Shein or something the following week. So then actually the Shein customers, they might have access to the design idea, at least, if not the actual like garment that the high fashion customers are supposed to be the first to get. Mm-hmm. And so that like creates an interesting like kind of confusion, and then like what, who is the luxury customer there? Because in the past, like I would say even just 10 years ago, the person that we would expect to be the person who has like the most buying power or who is the most important customer is the one that can get access to that design first. And so we would like recognize as people that the person who has those things soonest is the person who is like most in touch with like fashion or who has the most money, which may be like what they're trying to signal. But now in order to signal that sort of like class difference, you need to be doing something else entirely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You need to just be buying as much as you can rather than buying like the specific product that people want. And like you said, like trend prediction and trend analysis are real things that like these companies use in order to predict their own production calendar in the coming year or even like 2 to 3 years. But trend analysis on TikTok is not real. In my opinion,
it's like really fast as far as like what moves. But I will say that like, I know as somebody who's like just interested in fashion, you have to have like, if you want to read WGSN, which does like quarterly reports on like trends and trend analysis, you have to have like a corporate business account to access that, which is really interesting. Because like you said, like Virgil, where it's like they just take something from the runway, next day it's being sold at Zara. And I think in some ways the whole, I'd say, process of fashion has been devalued into something that's just there to consume, have a trend, have like a costume, be seen in it, and then just throw it away.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that would be the way that I would say that someone can signal class status now is just like how many things they have that they can treat disposably, rather than what is it that you have that shows like access to the latest designs or the most like well-made thing. Because if something is like coming from a fashion brand, even one that is not like designer, the clothes still need to be designed and then produced, and then the work has to be exhibited to buyers. There has to be a marketing campaign created for it. There needs to be models and photographers or graphic designers and like copywriters. There has to be like ad space that's produced, and then all of those steps just get flattened in the speed of production that exists now that allows like products of all kinds to be made within seemingly seconds and then also marketed within seconds just through like digital platforms. And so that like it isn't realistic anymore, I think, to like expect that someone who would want to signal their affiliation either with like a subculture through like aesthetic like markings or like a class status would have things in common with each other. That like, I don't think that we could assume that someone who is wealthy is going to be wearing clothes that are well made, or that someone who like listens to a particular like band that has a really strong like subculture is going to be dressing the same, because all of the barriers to access either of those things have just completely flattened.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like brands still need to market trends to us. So that's like, I think like where the confusion comes in.
The like entire art of like the rollout is almost like dead, and there's no like hype cycle for anything, because it's almost everything's fighting for your attention, where like, you know, you would read like a magazine and you'd see like an ad for like the new, or like a write up on like the new runway show or whatever, and then you think about it, and then like, oh, you might see like it like when you're walking down the street and you walk past the store and you're like, oh, that's that item. And then you start like seeing more campaigns, and it like builds excitement within you. Whereas like now it's like, as soon as you see the image, people are talking about it. And then right afterwards it's hitting the shelf, and then people are buying dupes of it.
It's like the words trending and viral have absolutely zero meaning to me anymore. I get on the internet and people are like, I can't believe, I feel so sorry for the people who bought the viral chair at $14, because now it's 4 cents. And it's like, first of all, when was this trend? This is the first time I'm hearing about it. And I don't think it's because, like, all these people are saying, like, I never heard about it because I'm just so old. It's not because you're old. It's because this person has been paid through an affiliate link through TikTok Shop, because it's TikTok Shop I'm talking about, really. Like, yeah. These people are getting paid through an affiliate link and incentivized through TikTok Shop to call it trending, to call it viral, so that they get more clicks on their affiliate link, so that they get more like money for their buck.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
they get told like, we'll send you this for a discount, or we'll send you this for free. And then you just talk about it, and then you get like any money that comes through this affiliate link. Right. So, and then you think about like, okay, so the chair was $14, a whole chair, $14. And now it's like 4 cents. And you're saying it's on sale for 4 cents. Why are they able to sell it for 4 cents? Why are they able to sell you a piece of furniture for 4 cents on TikTok Shop? Like, where, what money are they getting from that? And it's because there's the labor that goes into making that fucking crisscross chair is nothing. There's nothing. There's no labor that goes into I'm saying in terms of payment, right? The people who built that chair get paid absolutely dick. They get paid fucking nothing. And like that, now you're able to buy it for 4 cents on the dollar, and they're calling it trending and viral just to get inside of your head. And that's just like, that's insane to me that like you can just call it viral and nobody even bats an eye.
Everything has to be now. Yeah.
They're telling me it is.
I mean, I think all marketing is like trying to get inside of your head in order to sell you something. But I think that what you are speaking about like gets at the alienation that I'm thinking of. Where, like, yeah, in the past, a trend cycle, like, gradually takes time. where there are like maybe individual pieces of it that make its way into the market. And then there is excitement that builds for it. And then more and more things fit into that trend and more people become excited for it until it reaches a point of saturation and then it's done. And so if something is being called viral or a trend, the idea is to try and inform you that whatever it is that you are being sold like fits into that same story. But it is very difficult now for anything to fit into that kind of story because of the amount of time that is necessary for that kind of excitement to build and for people to like not totally have access to it so that they continue to be excited for it or like continue to want to find ways to participate in it. And so I think as you or as anyone else is being told like this is viral or this used to be viral and it's not anymore, this was a trend and now it's not, and you're looking at it and wondering like, where was I when this trend was happening? I didn't notice it. And then you start to feel more divorced from like mass culture because you don't remember participating in a trend. And maybe you remember that you used to participate in trends. So if the reason that you're not now, like, is maybe that's because you're getting too old or because you're not in touch, rather than like, I think everyone, regardless of age, is feeling a similar sort of alienation from like mass culture.
Yeah.
Cause like the monoculture is kind of just like, it's so splintered now. Like nobody's watching like the same TV shows or talking about like the same movies and all of that. And if they are, it's like 9 different subcategories of like subcategories, and like these kind of social groups and social cliques are now completely split off.
Mm-hmm. It's why Marvel's totally flopping, because it used to be an event to go see a Marvel movie. Everybody on Earth went to see a Marvel movie, and now everyone's like, ugh, like, I'm tired. I don't want to see 6 Marvel movies in a row.
They played all of them.
Yeah.
At like my local theater, I think when Endgame came out,
yeah,
they played like all of them back to back.
People and went.
Like, that's insane. Yeah. That's like 28 hours.
It's 28
like,
hours. And people went. People went. The Funko Pop owners went. They all wanted to go.
So, I mean, it's just, it's a lot of colors. Like, I feel like I can't be stimulated that much for 24 hours straight.
Even if there were lunch breaks. I need her to take me to the park for like a hot moment to breathe, suck in some air.
We need to do like a nap break and like a solid like snack time.
Like, a movie marathon is one thing, but usually like a movie marathon in like an independent theater is like 4 hours at most. Like, they're like, okay, we're going to show like 3 or 4 movies, right? Like, that's going to be a lot. Like, we're going to say like, you can like leave and come back anytime. Like, they're trying to be like accommodating to the fact that this is like kind of crazy. But like, then
they're like strapping you in at the Marvel movies.
But the Marvel movies, they got you like Clockwork Orange in, like, you will know every single name of every single comic book character. And now they can't even get you in them. They can't even get you in the door. They don't want, like, they can't get anybody in there. They're flopping hard. Like, it's crazy. They're like in a way where like nobody ever thought they would.
What the smell was like inside of the 28-hour Marvel movie-thon. Like, I want to know what the smell was like at hour 27. I'd peek my head in just to experience that, and then I'd step
out. I need the KN95 on for that. Like, stale.
It just smelled like stale air.
Yeah, stale
I can imagine.
And just like boxed farts.
I can't imagine.
Just nasty. Oh, my God. A week and a half ago, Cora Harrington, a.k.a. like the... She is like
the lingerie addict.
She is like known for being very, very intelligent about like fashion production, especially when it comes to lingerie, but also other pieces. And she posted these 2 photos side by side of like, this is what a skirt is supposed to look like cut on a bias, and this is what a skirt looks like not cut on a bias. And like, what do you prefer? And like, people a lot younger seem to reply to her tweet like, I like the skirt on the left that isn't cut on the bias. Like, I like the skirt that's improperly cut. I like that.
Well, they said that they liked that one because it looked more youthful.
Yes.
Which I think, like, again, like, gets at, like, it is no longer a relevant signal that something is made well or made with care or made by an artisan or with, like, luxurious materials, because the, like, I think the signal is just like how many things do you have. So like, lots of people are going to own really like shittily made skirts. Mm-hmm. And the more important thing is that they have it.
And sometimes not, something like, kind of like shittily like. Made is like part of the art, you know? Like I can see like some artists, like when they make something out of like remade materials or they make a collage, they're trying to say, like with their piece of clothing, you know, they're trying to say something.
My thoughts on DIY shit. I'm tired of seeing it.
They've changed.
I live in West Philadelphia, and I think that we need to put an end to DIY culture. Some things you should not do yourself.
I will say.
You're not rocking with the do-it-yourself?
Mike Wilcoat, the old ladies in Oregon, they love me. They want me so bad. They all think I'm like... I'm their, like, hot younger girlfriend they want to take to the south of France. Like, the second I put that on, the old lesbians, they're here. They want me so bad.
They flock
to they're into it. Because they've never seen anything like it before. They're like, because they do quilting, but they don't think, like, let me turn it into a jacket. So they're like, this is blowing my mind. And even though there are, like, hundreds of stores now that do this thing, like, where they take the quilt and they turn it into a coat.
And I support that. And that is a different thing for my West Philadelphia roommate finding various objects outside, bringing them into our home, and then saying, I think I could find a use for this. And I go, but what is it? And then she's like, I'm not sure, but I think I could maybe turn it into like a stool or something. I'll tell you a thing. And then I'm going to move on because I want to talk about music. But I'll tell you, she found... like a motorcycle, moped thing outside that was abandoned and
oh, I remember
not
this.
Working.
Yeah.
And she brought it
She took
inside,
it in?
Brought it inside.
Like a shelter cat?
Left it in our kitchen for like months and months and was like, at some point I'm going to fix it, but it's not working. I can't figure out why it isn't working. Doesn't fix it. But yesterday she did after a year of
wow. It's finally happened.
Yes. And so... I don't know if she fixed it, but she at least started tinkering with it. She comes inside and she says, I found out why it wasn't working. And I said, oh, why is that? And she said, it's because there were a dozen dead mice inside the bike.
No.
Ew.
And that's why you
so like she never
don't
got the
bring
engine.
Stuff inside.
That was in your kitchen. Yeah. Dead mice in your kitchen.
Yeah, I
a dozen. That's a nursery rhyme.
I'm so tired of found objects. I'm tired of DIY found projects.
The sewing is one thing. The dead mice and the motorcycle.
Need to get the skill.
No. It's like, did you want to do some DIY taxidermy? Like, why do we need the mice in here?
She's living out the Sydney Sweetie fantasy, like let her be, you know, Sid's garage, Sid's kitchen.
So I had to institute a rule that if any things are brought inside our home, she has to first check before they come inside if there are dead mice in them.
So you have like a quarantine like zone now in your house where it's like, oh, here's what I found. Let me put it in there and ask this.
Put it in the cube. It goes in the cube or it goes nowhere else, like.
Anyway, music. I think music is another good example of like technological advances happening really, really rapidly over the past century, and now we're in a special new time, because like for the majority of human history, not even the past like 300 years, but like all time up until like 100 years ago, music was happening live, and that's it. Like the cultural production of music, if there was an innovation that happened in that sphere, that would be like there is a new instrument, there is a new composition style, there is like an introduction of another culture's style into like an existing style of music, and then there is necessarily going to just be an amount of time for people to embrace and adapt to those changes, whether it's like people need to learn that new instrument and become experts in it, or they need to learn how to compose something in this new style. And so that like creates sort of like an inherent limit on how fast those kinds of like trend cycles could be, because there's no way that something could come in and out of style the way that like music has for the past century, where it's like something comes out of style in a decade. That would be really, really fast for like a time period where, you know, like you're only hearing music live. And so like people have to learn an instrument that might take a decade in itself if you're getting introduced to a new style of music live and you bring it elsewhere.
The way that like, because like you look at like A&Rs and like bands like that and like how they were discovered, and that cycle, there was almost a cycle of like working an artist and like taking time to like curate them before they were sold as like a bigger product to the market. And like I think that ties back into like the production cycles a lot more. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's like really interesting about like the way even music, it seems like it's just all being thrown at the wall.
Yeah, the idea of an industry plant, like that is what you're describing, is like a label sees that there is a talent in someone, or that there like there might be something there, and knowing that either like the trend that they feel like this person exists in is going to continue for enough time that it is like a worthwhile investment to cultivate those talents and like build a campaign around them, or like foreseeing that there is going to be a trend at some point that they fit in.
They keep them on retainer and
considerably less. Yeah, than it doesn't. People would imagine now, despite how often the term industry plant gets lobbied around, I don't think that that sort of like, investment.
I think
is being
what
made
they are, what they are seeing is people who either like the Nepo baby, right? They're seeing people who like are a part of, they're seeing somebody who, you know, like their parents are already part of the industry. Like you could argue that like Taylor Swift is a part of this, where like her dad was like very influential in like the beginning of her career. And I'm going to say this without worrying about getting death threats, because what can they do to hurt me? I'm really offering myself up to the piranha pool here, but you know, he was really instrumental in the beginning of her career of like getting her in the door with these record executives that he knew, right? You could argue that in a sense that is Nepo baby behavior. You could also just argue like one-to-one, you know, like Ben Platt got his like foot in the door with like musicals because his dad was like well-known, or like because his parents were well-known. Beanie Feldstein's brother is, you know, Jonah, that kind of shit. You could argue that there's quite a few people who like had wealthy parents and had a lot of like capital to be able to take this moment and kind of run with it. And that's what people are kind of, I think, responding to, but they are just calling it industry plant. And then some people just like don't fucking know what they're talking about, and they'll call Chapel Run an industry plant, despite her story being that she got rejected multiple times from multiple different labels and got dropped several times and had to go be a nanny for like a couple years and move back home and then come back because her songwriter was working with Olivia Rodrigo and was busy. So she had to get dropped again, you know?
I think the issue. Chapel Ronan thing is like a good example. Cause I think of, have y'all seen that like rapper kid Ian in the like Sperry's?
And he's Ian. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had never heard of him before, and I'm like, this is an industry plant, because like, I saw like Chapel Ronan from like other people's like tweets and stuff, but then like all the big hip hop accounts were talking about Ian. I ain't never heard no song by Ian ever before. And then here comes this little dude hitting the like call me outside. And I'm like, this feels force, right? It was like a few years ago after XXL, like one of the freshman like classes, I want to say it was like 2016. I want to say it was like the Rari guy. Nobody had ever heard of him whatsoever. And it's really funny that like all these, with all this money and talent and A&Rs going into artists, they still shelf like artists that I would personally love to see like new music by. Like I would love like a new Sky Ferreira album. The woman has been teasing it for 10 years and is like in like artist jail, like free Sky Ferreira, let her release Masochism.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that this conversation never leads somewhere better, where like you're talking about like who owns people's masters, right? Like why is Maddie Healy allowed to own Rina Sawayama's masters and like not release them. Ooh. Why is Scooter Braun like allowed to just have all of this power over these different artists? You know, like there's a lot of people that even like, I think virtually you and I know who have been in the music industry who like are dealing with a lot, like a lot of the time, and don't make a lot of money despite being very, very, very popular. And are like touring all over the place because of the record companies and because of the record industry. You'd think this kind of industry plan conversation would lead somewhere where people are like, if there are people who are on this company's bankroll to wait to be popular, what about the people who did work their way up and are popular, but are making very little money, or they still have to do sponsorships for fucking Windex and, you know, paper towels,
Windex,
and like hemorrhoid cream and like do mobile game ads, you know, like why do they still not make enough money from the record company? Like, and the records that they make, why are they making cents on the dollar from Spotify? You know?
Yeah. And I think also like something that has happened with technological advances and production cycles speeding up is that it is harder to like clock those sort of class disparities in terms of like what kind of music does someone make or what music do they listen to, what sort of scene is someone a part of, the way that you would have in the recent past and also like in the much further away past. Because yeah, all music in the past like used to be live, but that could either mean like that you can afford to go to a concert hall or to an opera, or that you have a private musical education, like there's a piano in your house, which used to be a display of wealth. Or, you know, are you being exposed to music through like mobile instruments and like folk singers and travelers, at like informal community gatherings? So like, regardless of who you were still experiencing music live, but that like class disparity is very, very apparent in like what tools you get to experience that music with, either as a musician or as an audience member. And that changed in the late 1800s. And I learned that the U.S. Civil War is responsible for why we have musical genres.
Really?
Because they were, the phonograph came out in the late 1800s, and then music was becoming more mobile because of that. And marching bands in the U.S. Civil War were recording their marching songs, and that was getting like passed around to people who were supporting the war effort on either side. And then as like the radio was introduced, which was also like late 1800s, early 1900s, then there were newly minted music companies, and they wanted to have a reason for why you would buy their phonograph rather than another company's. So then they started recording like any of the like established folk music styles, as opposed to what you would hear in the concert halls. And that was what people were buying. And so then you would go and like purchase a phonograph of like vaudeville or jazz or bluegrass. And then there was a push in the early 1900s as well, because like listening to music on the phonograph or on the radio became like associated with lower class, because the wealthier people could still, like they were still enjoying the experience of going to concert halls, that music companies started recording like classical music, and like pressing records of that. And like I found this quote from the National Music Monthly in 1917, where a journalist said, "Why is this great interest and enthusiasm for opera so suddenly developed?" Almost every layman will answer with the two words, the phonograph. And so like that came out of, it was the Victor Talking Machine in 1903 that they recorded Enrico Caruso, who is the European tenor opera singer, to try and squash the vaudeville associations with the phonograph. And that was so successful that then other music labels began producing their own. And what I find interesting about that is that like in 1903 is when they were beginning this like recording of opera singers. And it is all the way in 1917 where journalists are writing about like, wow, like this trend has really exploded. And that is like a relatively much shorter period of time than would have been the norm like in the previous 100 years. But now I can't really imagine a musical style being introduced to the general public and then 15 years later is when a journalist is like, I wonder what's going on here. Why is this happening? Like by that point, that analysis would have already been done and it would have been like passe for someone to be like, I wonder where this trend is coming from.
Yeah. Now it's like, it's something that you talked about previously a couple years ago where it's like quite a few journalists don't really understand what the difference is between neighborhood gossip and a trend. Mm-hmm. Like there's quite a few people who are like, this person is the next up and coming artist. And it's just like a person from their neighborhood who like says slurs, like, you know, in like Dumbo or whatever. And like that, it's just weird how like, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of like moving parts to like what will become the next trend. And I don't like want to blame somebody for like wanting to believe that something like could potentially be happening here. Especially as like mild popularity starts to like gain traction. 'Cause you never know, especially like if you're trying to work in like the business of tracking trending, for journalistic reasons. But you know, I think there's a certain level where like there's a distinction to be made between like, okay, what here like is working and what is just a lot of like TikTok viral marketing, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, and I what's going to resonate and you won't really know, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think like it's kind of interesting because it's all trying to kind of hit that perfect like breaking point of like, I found this thing and it actually like worked. And I think it's interesting that you had brought up Virgil, like people don't find music like 15 years later, but like I think of like found like audio recordings, like somebody like Connie Converse, who like literally had like passed away, and then afterwards her family had like actually like, you know, sent her music out and like it ended up getting pressed on like records and all of that. And the woman ended up like going missing, I think. I don't know the mystery off the top of my head. But I think that's kind of interesting. But it's also like, have we reached like this breaking point culturally where is there almost no new conceptual music genres that can be made anymore?
Oh, God, I don't know. I do think that it's maybe different from like someone discovering like a style of music that was dormant or like was recorded 15 years ago but wasn't popular, but rather that like a trend continues to pick up steam and has like reached its saturation point 15 years in rather than like perhaps a year or two in. I feel like this would be the equivalent of someone writing in the year 2008, like, why is everyone listening to grunge music? Where'd that come from? And it's, you know, like if like that analysis would obviously be like tired and silly because we would expect people to have already like done that, have gone through the trend cycle and have moved on to something else. But when like the speed of production was slower and when the tech did not allow for things to be disseminated as quickly, it was perfectly reasonable that like a trend could be continuing to pick up steam to the point where within like 17 or 15 years, someone is still trying to make sense of why it's happening or where this trend is coming from because it hasn't yet reached that saturation point. But then as like the like technological advances became more advanced in the 1900s, then there was this explosion of new music genres in big part because music labels wanted to be able to like capitalize on different areas of the market and appeal to them. And the cost of like pressing a record is considerably less than like hosting a musician in a concert hall. So you could take a chance on an artist that might have had what would have been considered like too small of an audience to like host them in a concert hall and expect people to buy tickets. But if people are listening to them enough on the radio or are willing to like purchase a record, then that might be okay to mm-hmm. like allow this person to be signed to your label and to give them a budget and to create something with them. And that like just inevitably allows for more like diversity and like stratification like within.
It feels like a lot of them aren't given a lot of room to grow and foster themselves. And like on a similar note, they're also being a lot of the labor is being put on them to market themselves mm-hmm. and do everything themselves. Like a lot of them, like even big artists, like even Charlie XCX will like get on TikTok and be like, my label is forcing me to like do this.
I think that that's,
you could say that's part of the marketing.
It
probably is cap, but there are quite a, like,
say that again, Kenny.
Cap. But there's probably like there are quite a few like independent artists who are like being signed to labels and then like told like, okay, well, like, you know how like when you were signed in a label back in the day, like we would do a lot of the shit for you and we would print all of your merch and we would get all of your merch deals and book your venues. You have to do that now. You have to do your marketing and you have to do all of your stuff.
And then they get mad when they're like not doing it. It's like this weird thing where it's like a blank check, but none of the tools to like actually like put like that music out there.
Yeah, I think it's like an inability to grapple with the fact that there is this like need for a really fast time of output in order to promote like work. And so if the kind of work is music, like you still need musicians to make the music. You need like time spent recording the music. You need the music to be released and then promoted to distributors and like media professionals, like all of those things, regardless of how fast it might be to record something now or how easy it is to like create like a sound that is interesting on your computer. Like those things still take time because they require people and people's labor. But the like market that exists is one that is used to those like things coming out very quickly and being promoted to them quickly. And so there's just this disparity in like, what is it, what is actually possible for someone even with a huge budget to do if they want to promote something and have it have lasting power and like have it create a trend in the music industry? Like how are people supposed to then fit into that trend if they're inspired by it? Because the amount of time that it might take them to like create something that fits into it, they're maybe going to be like 2 years too late to the thing. And I feel like they're like, you could do a similar analysis for other mediums of art, but I'm not sure if I have the like skill set to think about what those would be. But I do think that just in general, the speed of production, like as it increases with those technological advancements, is still like, there is tension with the speed at which those goods can still be sold to us. And that puts limits on what the process is going to be in terms of like what is going to feel exciting to people that are consumers or like audience members, and how possible it is for like artists or like cultural workers to create something that is going to feel like culturally resonant with people.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, I think it's really interesting because I know I asked this question, but like as you were like kind of giving your answer, Virgil, I was thinking about like examples. I think about like, oh, what created a genre and how like My Bloody Valentine like created shoegaze. Not like they didn't create shoegaze, but it was like a bubbling thing, but they like almost bankrupted their label creation in the process of making Loveless because it was like it took so long to mix and master. And I think that's really interesting because sometimes like there is like a shift in like the market of like culture and all of that. And like if a good product is good, it will speak for itself. But I think sometimes culturally, this goes back to kind of like the core part of the conversation, like almost everything's moving too fast.
And I feel like a lot of people take that fear of everything moving too fast, and sometimes they like take it a little bit too far and run away with it. Like when electronic music was first coming out and like auto-tune was happening, right? Everyone was like, oh, like this is just going to make things worse for music. And it's just like, and people have like a vitriolic hatred for like Kesha and T-Pain because they were using auto-tune. Mm-hmm. And they thought that that was like manufactured and like not authentic good music when like electronic tools were able to help people kind of produce certain sounds a little faster or with a little more like fine tuning at like a rate that was easier to produce. But like those people were like T-Pain and Kesha were using that sound very specifically for a specific reason to sound a certain way. Mm. And even now, like when with Brat coming out, you see a lot of people talking about how like, oh, well, like people are trying to compare like her and like other pop stars as if like Charlie is trying to be like a vocalist. And people like don't mm-hmm. really understand like where their the overlap of their music trends like lies. Where they're like, they assume that every artist is like going for the same goals, right? Of certain things.
It's like how like T-Pain was using auto-tune and like his, because I think he only did it in like the key of D, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. And it's like, it's an artistic like vision. And I think, I don't know, it's just interesting the way like consumers respond to products.
Yeah, I think that that is also a different kind of moving too fast than what Laura was, than what I was imagining at least, because I feel like Kesha and T-Pain and like other artists who were making music, maybe using a newer kind of technology, they were still coming out of an existing scene, mm-hmm. and so like mm-hmm. the scene evolves with people's participation in it and their like introduction of new ideas, but like into something that exists already and like belongs to like a tradition of like people that have been doing something together for a while. And that is how you get new genres, is like mm-hmm. at some point all of those people have gotten tired of making the same exact thing. And then either like someone comes along and does something different, or they break the mold themselves.
And kind of open the door for other people to see it. Like PC music using, almost like it broke away from SoundCloud and like into the public sphere.
Using a brand new kind of technology is not quite the same as like something moving so fast to the point that there's no scene. Mm-hmm. So there's mm-hmm. like no, that like that grounds of like, collaboration and creativity can't really exist because people are trying to move on to the next thing quickly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or like trying to make sure that they are capitalizing on whatever the next thing is. And that is how fashion trends work too, is like you're supposed to be existing within some kind of like subculture, culture that like fits you and your sense of style. And then at some point you get tired of seeing everyone doing the same thing, so you introduce something new to it. And I think that probably functions the same for all sort of like aesthetic movements. And there is not enough time, like either for a scene to be established, and like definitely not enough time for it to exist long enough for things to change within it.
This is how I spent a lot of time arguing with people about how indie sleaze was not called indie sleaze. It was called being a hipster, and you didn't want to be called mm-hmm. a hipster, because if anyone called you out for doing the obvious signaling of your in-group that you were doing, then they were tapping into like the cultural movement that you were a part of, and you didn't want to like say that you were a part of mm-hmm. a cultural movement. Like the whole point of it was that you were anti-cultural movement, and the second it was starting to get popular enough that the Ushankas and your, you know, PBR was getting sold near an Urban Outfitters, or like starting to get inside the Urban Outfitters, then you had to start distancing yourself from like the entire,
because Urban Outfitters will eat it up. Urban Outfitters will take it, it comes out completely different. Mm-hmm. Urban Outfitters is weird as like a cultural touchstone, because it's like they were considered a record store, and like they got like original pressings or like variant pressings of records and stuff like that, because they were still this like corporate like monolith. But like you look at like some artists like Lana Del Rey, and like the Urban Outfitters variant is the most expensive variant of her record. And it was weird because I used to work at Urban Outfitters, like I always call it Suburban Outfitters, but it was a weird place to work because it was like countercultural cool, but it was still like, oh, I'm going to take the kids here shopping. All right, here's $200 each. And then like as I'm ringing up their like $400 ticket, I hand them a mixtape cassette in the year 2017.
Yeah.
And it's like there's this weird like dissonance to it as a whole, because it's like both corporate and like, hey, fellow kids, mm-hmm. cassettes.
Especially because they own, like, Urban Outfitters is a part of, like, a larger corporate conglomerate that owns, like, Anthropology and, like, Free People and, you know, these, like, aesthetic movements that are, like, meant to describe a certain type of even just, like, music, like, as a fashion brand. But they are, like, and they signal a certain type of wealth and status, at least back in the day, right? Like, Free People especially. Well, you know, like 10 fucking years ago.
Like, so 2015?
Yeah.
Okay. But I feel like Urban Outfitters was done by 2015.
Really?
But
really?
I think so. I mean, I feel like maybe my association with it was actually always that it was a little bit like uncool if you were a part of like any of the sort of like movements that it was appealing to, because you weren't supposed to buy your hipster shit at the store.
Right.
Like, you're supposed to either, like, make it or, like, get it from somewhere else. And then it just, like, happens to fit into that aesthetic. So I always thought that, at least by the time that I was paying attention to Urban Outfitters, that it had sort of the, like, it existed in the same sort of sphere that Hot Topic did. It's like you're not supposed to be going to the scene store to buy the scene stuff.
It's
you're
very
supposed
to funny
be going to the normal store.
How like these like words just take on an entirely new meaning. Like suddenly hipster is just indie sleaze now. They just gave it a new name, and it's like you were not indie sleaze. You were browning out at the Santa Gold concert. You were reblogging Terry Richardson photos. I know who you are. Like if you were a part of it, I'm saying I knew who you were. Anything. Like if you were a part of it, you were not indie sleaze. You were a hipster. You didn't want to be called a hipster. You were browning at the Santa Gold concert. You were reblogging Terry Richardson photos, and you were wearing Yanushenka in August and nearly dying of a heat stroke. I know you, because you were me.
That's how it be sometimes. And I think, like, it's so funny because, like, culturally speaking, like, Urban Outfitters, like, going, like, when I think of it, I think of, like, how, like, Virgil, you said, like, it was uncool by that time. Like, my boss, like, felt the same way, where she would always talk about, like, Urban Outfitters, by the time I worked there, was essentially fast fashioning, like, other brands, where, like, when she had worked there, like, it was a curation of smaller brands and, like, bringing them in. So, like, I think they were one of the first companies to carry, like, UNIF, mm-hmm. if y'all remember yeah. UNIF.
Yeah, they were one of the first, I believe.
I had the Hellbounds.
Some of their shoes are still, like, rocking it for some people, I've noticed. But
when I worked at Buffalo, like, people would, oh my, we could not keep like any like vintage in quotes unit in the store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's out of here, like it's gone. Yeah, and it's funny how like that
and
kind
I
of
was
fashion
the one
signaling
that was
like
it.
Belies. Yeah, the fashion signaling kind of belies the music signaling, right? Like Urban Outfitters was supposed to be originally a record store, or like how certain aesthetic movements were part of something else. Like Vice used to be a skate magazine, you know, like that was like the first kind of thing that they were doing.
Really? I didn't know they used to be a skate magazine.
They used to
like
be a skate magazine
day.
Back in the day. They were just like, it was all about skating for the most part to start off.
Was that when they were run by the Proud Boys guy?
I think a little before that, but like
the Proud Boys guy. That's crazy.
Yeah,
it's just like, it's weird to, it's
was
Gavin. Something, yeah.
I know he was doing some weird stuff.
Yeah,
for
he was
like,
weird. He had a podcast.
He got booted
at this place I was interning at, and got fired like the month that I was working. Because they were like, he's too much. Like he can't. Like he comes in super fucking late, and he's just like he. This was like I want to say like 2014. Like it was the summer of 2014. Mm-hmm. I like interned at like a podcast studio. And he had like the podcast there that was basically their cash cow that was bringing in money. But that month that I worked there, they were like, it's not working. Like it's not worth it. Like even if he's the main source of our income, he doesn't show up on time. He's irate and he's like bad to work with. And frankly, like he's constantly looking for other deals despite not getting them. And like, we need to just drop this dude like ASAP. And they dropped him. And then I guess a year later he became a Proud Boy. So he became leader of the Proud Boys. So he, you know,
not the leader. He went straight to the top.
He went straight to the top. And he was, you know, he had his own podcast network. So it was fine. You know, he made
Vice is weird.
Yeah.
Man.
It's a weird place.
Cause they had the whole, like my introduction was like Vice goes to North Korea. Mm-hmm. And it was like such like a guerrilla like documentary at the time. And like, it's crazy. Cause like Vice has a TV channel now.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's so weird to think about that. Like, yeah, they used to be a skate company and now they do this where they're both like corporate, but then
I think that leads to the nostalgia cycle though, is that you have these places who, you know, they started off like doing a certain thing, that was considered counterculture. Or even just like people would, even if you went back even further, you could consider that these companies were co-opting counterculture according to the people who were in it at the time. And now they're just like something completely different and people like yearn for the time when like Hot Topic was like selling goth shit. And now they're just selling like Rick and Morty pajamas. And I'm like, I think at the time, even goths were like, Hot Topic is not it. Like, we hate Hot Topic.
Like, spiritually, what is the difference between that and like Invader Zim socks?
Not much.
It's the same.
Not much.
I mean, yeah, but, like, I feel like even then, I know, like, I was part of the Invader Zim generation. I know, like, the old head goths would be like, this is not the Hot Topic. I know there's too many, like, Nickelodeon characters in here. Like, it's...
Bring back my leather collars and my fucking JNCO jeans. No more
Invader Zim. For me, I got a Fred t-shirt at Hot Topic. Mm-hmm. So that's my
They were selling, like, the annoying orange, like, they were selling, like, YouTube merch, like, around that time. Which is very funny to me. But yeah, it's weird how they are extremely tied. Like the music industry and the fashion industry are like, you know, they're holding hands all the way down to hell.
All industries are holding hands.
Mm-hmm. And French three-way kissing, four-way kissing, all the way down in
the
hell.
The challengers, a challenger's year.
Yeah. And so I think the thing that like we have like gotten at a couple times is that despite the fact that like there is now this consumer driven need for faster production, and even with like technological advances making some of that possible, that there's still a pretty significant gap in which like the thing that people might want and the speed at which it can be delivered to them is truly possible. And a lot of that like the reason for that just comes from the internet, which in itself is a story about the process of the speed of production changing, because in the early and late 1990s, which I guess is also the late 1900s.
The 1900s.
Yeah. Home computers, like those were a novelty that were slowly seeing adoption. So advertisers couldn't rely on reaching people like strictly through having a website, and digital advertising at that time, like even up until the early 2000s, it really did just look like having a website.
Yeah.
Like they were not selling you stuff on the website. It was just letting you know that the company exists.
Yeah. Here's the address. Here's the phone number. Like it was basically just a business card. Like it was just like, okay, here you go. Like this is where you can reach me, essentially.
The ye old yellow pages. Mm-hmm.
Right. Like online shopping was such a novelty. Like Amazon didn't even exist until 1994. And for its first, I think like 5 years, it was strictly an online book selling company. So if you were like shopping remotely, that would be through a catalog and not through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still like a pretty big barrier of speed that is happening there, because the catalog needs to be produced. It needs to be sent to you, and then you need to go through it and like make your selections.
And then call a number. Yeah.
Or call them. I don't know. It takes like 3 to 4 days to get your thing mailed to them, and then they're going to mail it back to you. So like the speed at which you could get something delivered to you, we're like looking at still like a month.
Very,
so the faster option would be going somewhere in person.
You have to like commit to buying stuff back then rather than like just impulse buying. So it's like almost every purchase mattered a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
because now you can get like anything.
There are quite a few like older episodes of television, like even like kids television, like Lizzie McGuire, right? Where she's like wants this pair of jeans like so bad. But in order to get that pair of jeans, she needs to save up for like 4 to 8 weeks of like chores and like allowance money and doing all of this stuff. And then by the time she like gets that money, she's like, I don't actually want the jeans. Like I want something else. Like that's like the little like lesson of the day for like the children at home, right? It's like, oh, save your money. But then maybe once you save your money, you won't even want that thing anymore. You'll want to save up for something else. And then I've taught you as the television writer, responsible buying. But now it's like Lizzie would just buy that fucking pair of pants for $4 on Shein and then wait like maybe 2 days for to come to her house.
Also in 4 to 8 weeks, it might not be on the website anymore. Because like
there's a,
oh no,
I don't know.
For some reason, there's a line in this like cool pants episode of Lizzie McGuire where she gets the pair of pants. And I just like, for some reason, it's a non line.
You remember this.
It's a boring line, but I remember just like, for some reason, it just like stuck with me so much that I just kept repeating it all the time. It's the way she like pronounced it, where she was like, hey Lizzie, very cool pants. Just, I lost it. Like, and so for some reason, the
why
way.
Why did you just like pull a memory out of my head? Like
for some reason, the way that she pronounced "very cool pants," it stuck with me so much. Like I remember saying to my friends, I would be like, "Very cool pants." It's like a little weird, like kids joke that I would do with like my friends. Very odd time, but yeah, now the pants would be like $2, and they would like.
Did y'all watch the like she wore those jeans like me? Mm, y'all remember that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking of, not the very cool pants.
Mm-hmm. She wore those jeans just like me.
she was like mad, mm-hmm, that girl wore, like she was pressed in that music.
What's your
video.
Email, Lizzie? Lizzie at imabigfatloser.com.
they were like roasting her for like repeating outfits, and I think that's like, I don't know, like that's funny that like that was taught to, mm-hmm, us like as a kid, because like that conditions you as an adult to like wear like, oh man, they already saw me in those pants.
Yeah, their even intention,
though they're really cool, can't wear them.
Their intention was to be like, you actually should be more responsible and like break the mold. But actually, like, I did actually just want the very cool pants. I didn't really care about like whether or not I was going to like be a responsible buyer. I just wanted my very cool pants.
Yeah, I also think, you know, okay, 15 years ago, is that when you were a child, right? Yes.
Probably. I would hope so.
I'm like, math is hard sometimes. But no, I think that like being able to not repeat outfits would definitely be a signal of like class.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it is entirely possible, although would be like a very irresponsible use of like of your budget, but it is possible to not be in like a high income bracket at all and like have tons and tons of clothes to the point where you do not need to repeat your outfits. I think I was seeing that the, and we can link it in the description to make sure that I'm correct, but the average Shein customer has a yearly income of like around $65,000. So those are not low income people. Mm-hmm. So like mid-range income people buying tons and tons of disposable clothing.
And it's funny how many people are like, this is the most accessible way I can get clothes.
Yeah, they are probably wearing those things once or twice because I don't think that those things last for like,
you look at them the wrong way. They like
they
disintegrate.
Fall apart, yeah.
So they're wearing those things once or twice and then discarding them and then making another purchase on Shein. And so like, I feel like 15 years ago, I would have imagined that someone who like never repeats an outfit, like that is a person with wealth.
Yeah.
But now you can achieve that for $65,000, which is like, you could have a barista job and then another barista job.
I'll tell you about the one time I purchased from Shein, and it was back in 2013. I just got into college and I needed a new pair of shorts.
Is that like Prussian?
It was called She Inside. It was called She Inside. It was not called She In. It was called She Inside. And I was like, I need a new pair of shorts. And I found this website because it was like the first result on Google. And I was like, okay, and I'll just get these. And I got them in what should have been my size. But at the time, Shein didn't make a lot of clothes in different sizes. It was a lot like Brandy Melville, but not like one size fits all, but more just like it had like four different sizes. And like it's like based on the measurement chart, it should be your size, but it's not at all because the other parts of the construction make it so that it can't fit over my legs and my ass. So like it can fit my waist, but not over anything else on my body. So I got it in. It took no joke, like 8 weeks to get there. Cause like Shein was not like a big fast fashion brand yet. It was mostly just relegated to China. And then they were like, okay, well, we'll start shipping internationally now, but it's going to take fucking forever. Like you're not going to get these clothes for a long time. So I waited 8 weeks. They finally came. And by that time it was like November. So like, I didn't even need the fucking shorts anymore. I try to put them on. They rip immediately because they don't actually fit my body. And then I threw them out and I was like, well, I'm never purchasing from that site again. That was a fucking rip. Yeah. And then years down the line, everyone's purchasing from Shein. And I'm like, Shein, do you mean Shein? And they're like, yeah, Shein. I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, you guys are still purchasing from that website, but they have all the wrong sizes. It takes 8 weeks. Apparently it doesn't anymore.
Yeah. It's because I remember, I want to say this is like 2013. Like, there's a term in like the men's fashion community called like the black mannequin site, where it's like these like random like sites that like they're like Shein, but they're not really. But you go there and they have like all these like shirts, right? Now keep in mind, this is like 2013. So like I get like four of these shirts, right? This is like my back to school clothing. And I'm like, oh, these shirts are so cool. They take like 8 weeks to get here and they're like this big. And then like I'm mad as hell because like, They barely fit, but like they're made out of the weirdest textured material. Granted, they did make me look like a Yakuza like video game like character, but like it's just like such a disparity in like the just basic quality and craftsmanship of what a shirt should be.
It's gesturing at the idea of a shirt.
Mm-hmm. It's a concept of a shirt.
The LaCroix of a shirt.
You're getting the concept. So actually, you're getting a firsthand look at the shirt. I think you should be honored, honestly, to be able to get such a premium experience of
$12
seeing the shirt before it should even be made. You're getting the experiments. Okay. You're getting the prototypes.
I'm going to try to wrap us up, maybe. What do you think? get back to the episode topic, perhaps. I think that the thing that I was noticing as I was looking at the progression of, I don't know, like fashion and music trends in particular, is that there became a point where consumers like no longer needed to primarily like maintain relationships with real life spaces in order to make those purchases. And in particular, like physical storefronts, if we're talking like CD stores or clothes stores or whatever, where the stores, like they have existing inventory that they need to then like put on sale when there is no longer going to be any left. And they can also like send back information about like what is being bought to whoever the like higher ups of the corporation is, that can then like create new marketing efforts based around assessing those trends. And it wouldn't have been wise from a profitability standpoint to have like trends that exist fast, like in a faster space of time than year to year, because of all of the time that would take in order to like make prop those things up. But now, and I think that like we saw actually in the 2008 recession that saw the closing of like, we had the stat on a previous episode, but I think it was like 70% of physical like brick and mortar storefronts were like shuttering during that time. And a lot of them just did not come back. And so now we're like living in this like weird liminal space era where you are you really don't need to maintain a relationship with any kind of physical spaces, whether it's like a music scene, like maybe you're not purchasing stuff, or be part of a fashion subculture. in order to participate in these kinds of trends. And I think that maybe my analysis of it is that, like, that is probably why so much marketing is now emphasizing nostalgia and trying to get people to participate in something that will take them back to a different era, because it is so much more work and it is not cost effective to try to, like, predict a trend and then create something that fits into it and, like, put the time and effort necessary into that, that would, like, allow that trend to be profitable if they were to create something for it.
Yeah. It's like everything has become hyper risk averse, and it's created this, like, weird cultural malaise where it's almost like a lack of enthusiasm in the people who are, like, producing the stuff, like people who are, like, producing the CDs, or, like, at least the entire marketing team. They feel less exciting because it's not a physical product as much. And I think it's kind of sad that we've kind of let that, like, kind of create, like, the creative, like, flair of that stuff, like, die down.
Yeah. So would you say that the worst decade for everything is right now?
Probably, but, like, I don't know. I feel like the 40s, maybe. I don't know, which is weird, but, like, I'm just, like, thinking, I'm like, yeah, like, there was some stuff in, like, the 60s and 50s that, like, kind of hit, like, the 70s, it was okay. The 80s were, like, wild, 90s, 2000s, but, like, now it's just kind of bland.
I would say the 80s kind of sucked, but just, like,
the 80s when I see them, were fun,
they
though.
They were fun. I feel like the music, like, when you actually, like, your dad will be like, oh my god, the music in the 80s is, like, perfect, and then you listen to it, and it's just, like, like, oh, you were on a lot of cocaine.
Pause, though.
You're listening to it in your room, not on coke.
That's the problem.
Diana Ross and Steely Dan. Yeah, so let's pause.
You know what? You got me there. You know what? Yeah.
Listen and learn, Kendall.
Yeah, I am. I'm sitting my white ass down, and I'm listening and learning to Steely Dan.
I mean, Steely Dan is white. That's about as white of a band as you can get.
Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening to Big Soy Naturals. Laura, is there anything you would like to promote at the end of our episode here?
Which is now.
I do a lot of content under the name CyberX Boyfriend. So yeah, that's where you can find me. I'm doing stuff at any given time. I don't know when this is going to come out, so I can't. So there's stuff there on YouTube, on TikTok, on Twitter, on Instagram.
Which one is your favorite one?
Kind of YouTube now, but, like, also TikTok. Like, TikTok's fun, but, like, I'm turning into, like, an old person where, like, I just kind of kiki on there. Mm-hmm. But, like, also, like, it is fun.
You got all the filters on and you're, like, you're duetting, like, men who are, like, half your age being like, when will it be
just
my
looking at the camera?
Just like the old people who are like have like the like bold glamour.
How
filter
do I
on.
Turn this off? I posted it by accident.
Exactly. Well, go follow CyberX Boyfriend on YouTube. I know you're releasing a lot of exciting stuff on there in the next couple months. So I will be very excited to see that. And you should too, as our pay pigs and prayer warriors. Speaking of, as our pay pigs and prayer warriors, you are legally mandated to follow us on social media. We are Big Soy Naturals everywhere. I am She Herzog everywhere. Virgil is Commodify This everywhere. Leave us a review on Apple and Spotify, please. That helps us, you know, get pushed through the algorithm. If you want to send us an email, you can send it to sorry@bigsoynaturals.world.
Okay. Bye.
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 I love Venn diagrams.
I don't want smoke, I just want smoke. 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 When I'm smoking beans, cause I'm on your team. When I smoke the seed, cause I'm such a fiend. High as a kite, smoking Walter White.
when I smoke the blue and I smoke the purple. Smoking on the blunt cause I wanna run. Smoking on the green cause it makes me lean. Smoking on and I smoke and scream. When I hit the blunt, it's a clean cut. When I hit the blunt, I give a fuck. When I hit the blunt, I don't give a fuck. I don't want smoke, I just want smoke. 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 When I hit the pipe, I'm like Walter White.
Walter.
When I hit the smoke, I feel like a dope.
Dope.
Yeah, I like green cause it makes me lean. And I smoke high cause I'm blowing clouds. When I'm getting high, then it's time to smoke. When I'm smoking loud, then it's time to blow clouds. When I hit the blunt, I don't give a fuck. When I hit the blunt, it's like give a fuck.
I don't want smoke, I just want smoke. I don't want smoke, I just want smoke. I don't want smoke, I just want smoke. I don't want smoke, I just want smoke.
Big Soy Naturals.